You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Coming up next, Economics for the People with your hosts, Sirisha Naidu and Taki Manolakos.
Nos dices que debemos sentarnos, pero las ideas solo pueden levantarnos, caminar, recorrer, no rendirse ni retroceder, ver, aprender como esponja absorbe. Nadie sobre todos, faltan todos, suman todos para todos, todo para nosotros. Soñamos en grande que se...
Hello everyone, this is Sirisha, and I have with me here Taki.
Hello everyone, welcome to Economics for the People.
This is tax season, so we're going to start our Econ 101 section with a discussion on income taxes, sales taxes, what do they mean, what is the class dimension of it, how are classes impacted by it?
Absolutely. And that's a very important topic. And after we talk about our Econ 101 segment, we're going to have our usual dollars and cents debrief with the dollars and cents co-editor, Chris Sturr. And we're going to be talking about prison labor.
And then finally, we, in our special feature, we are going to talk about industrial disaster. Judy also already mentioned it appears as if both shows decided to focus on industrial disasters. Well, Judy's show, Heartland Labor Forum, talked about East Palestine, Ohio. We're going to talk about industrial disaster that happened in 1984, and we're going to have a discussion about how do you locate social justice? How do you get justice when there's an industrial disaster? So a great show, folks, and really looking forward to our conversations.
Let's rock and roll.
This is our Econ 101 segment, and what do we do in our Econ 101 segment is we unpack some aspects of the economy and common economic concepts and terms, and I want to remind our listeners that we want to hear from you. Which concepts, issues, terms about the economy and economics do you want to hear about on our show? You can write to us via email, but also message us on Facebook or Instagram. They're available on our KKFI website. Also, now we are on Apple Podcasts, in case podcasts are your preferred method of tuning in. And remember that KKFI has its own podcast app, which you can download from Google Play or Apple. So Taki, what is our segment about today?
Well, this month is going to be all about taxes. So we have two important dates coming up pertaining to taxes, which is April 2nd and April 15th. On April 2nd, Jackson County, Missouri voters will decide on a sales tax package of $2 billion over 40 years for our local sports teams, the Kansas City Chiefs, which is the football team, and the Kansas City Royals, which is the baseball team. And of course, our federal tax returns are due on the 15th this year. And I have to say, Americans have a very complicated relationship with taxes. We certainly enjoy the many benefits that taxes provide, including Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, roads, airports, and actually a lot more. On the other hand, some taxes subsidize questionable spending.
So, Taki, what is interesting is that, people seem to, or some people seem to dislike paying income tax, but many support sales tax as a form of taxes. So why do you think they advocate for one but speak out against the other?
Well, could it be because they believe sales taxes are flat? I mean, that I think that's the reason. It's the same rate for everyone. And we see there is this kind of hysteria around the sales tax, and there's a movement towards flat taxes because people perceive them to be more fair. It's the same rate for everyone, and hence it's equal, whereas income taxes are higher as your income increases.
Sure, and I really find it interesting how sometimes these very regular concepts that we have to deal with year in and year out and every day are sometimes obscured from everyday understanding. So let's have a brief discussion about income and sales tax. But let's start with the income tax, right? So the federal government uses a system that taxes people differently at different income brackets, and the tax rate varies from 10% to 37%. And sometimes people think that they're paying the same tax rate on their entire income, which is not true. So if after deduction and adjustments, you have an annual taxable income of $60,000, let's say, then it means that you're taxed 10% on the first $10,275, and then you're taxed 12% for your income between $10,276 to $41,775, and then the remaining income is taxed at 22%.
And so on average, you're not paying 22% for the entire $60,000, which is a common misconception. Even billionaires in the highest tax brackets do not pay the same rate on their entire income. So if we divide total income taxes by total taxable income, we get what is known in the parlance as an effective tax rate. And this ends up being lower than the percentage in the brackets. So what the brackets do is make the income tax progressive. When we say the income tax is progressive, we mean that as your ability to pay improves, you pay more. What does that mean, Sarisha? Can you elaborate a little bit more?
So, like I said, you're not paying, you know, if your income is $60,000, you're not paying a flat rate of 22%, though that is what your last dollar is taxed at. So you're progressively, like you mentioned, Taki, you're progressively being charged at a higher tax rate for different amounts that you have earned. So why would we want that? So let me give an example, right? So let's say, you know, if we have a friend called Ramon who works at a fast food restaurant and makes a total income of, let's say, $100 a week, from which he has to pay rent, groceries, gas, etc. First of all, you know, he wouldn't make it through the week because the pay is too low. But correct. Just in case, right? Just in case, let's assume that he makes $100 a week. And let's say he loses $20, right? It fell out of his pocket or whatever. And that would be a big deal for him. That is 20% of his weekly pay. However, if someone like Elon Musk or Bill Gates or any other millionaire, billionaire loses $20 a week, and let's say that their income is $1 million a week, and sort of in reality, Elon Musk has a net worth of $206 billion, that is billion with a B, right? So in any case, if your income is $1 million a week, then paying $20 means nothing. So charging a billionaire only $20 as income tax is not equitable, right? We could be charging them much more without them feeling the pinch in the same way as Ramon, who just makes $100 a week, or anyone else who just has an income of, you know, $30,000 or $50,000.
So that's the income tax. Why don't we turn to sales tax so our listeners have more information related to the upcoming vote on April 2nd, since that election asks us to vote on a sales tax for Jackson County, Missouri. It would subsidize renovations at Arrowhead Stadium, which is where the Chiefs play, the football team, and subsidize a new stadium for the baseball team, the Kansas City Royals. So now the important point is that sales taxes are flat taxes. They tax consumption rather than income.
Right. And that's a very, very important distinction. There are serious implications of whether we tax consumption or income. And so we want to pay attention to that, right? So the total sales tax rate in any given location can be broken down into state, county, city, and special district rates. So I'm going to throw some numbers and I apologize. So Missouri, for instance, has a sales tax of 4.225%. And then Jackson County collects an additional 1.375%. So the minimum sales tax rate in Jackson County is 5.6%. And then each town or city within Jackson County could levy extra taxes. So for instance, within Jackson County, Kansas City has a sales tax rate, which is different from Independence, which is different from Lee's Summit, and all of these belong to the same county. So to compute the sales tax on any taxable item, so the cost of that item is multiplied by the tax rate, and that is what the additional amount that you're paying, you know, and that amount ends up going to the state or the city or county. So what are all these taxes used for?
So it's interesting. For Missouri, for instance, 1% of the sales tax goes to education. In terms of Kansas City itself, 0.5% of the sales tax goes to firefighters, 0.25% goes to public safety. At the county level, 0.125% of the sales tax goes to the Children's Services Board, and 0.375% goes to the stadium. So I'll,
right, and so Taki, if I can interject,
of course,
we have not listed out all the things that the taxes can be used for. We've just... We gave some examples.
Just some examples.
Right? And these are services that the city or the county or the state provides.
Correct. And along with state income taxes, sales taxes are an important source of revenue for the state and county. The problem is that they appear hidden to consumers since they're spread out over many purchases rather than paid in one lump sum. And many of us do not pay attention to the sales tax. We know this anecdotally, of course, but there is also research to suggest that people do not even know how much we're paying in sales tax.
Right. And, you know, so most people are unaware of this extra that amount that they have to pay in order to purchase and, you know, not paying attention to it. Now, sales taxes, remember we talked about income taxes being progressive because you get charged a little more as your income goes up. Sales taxes are inherently regressive. So it's the opposite. And, you know, when we say progressive, we don't like nothing to do with a political kind of affiliation or anything. So sales taxes are inherently regressive because of the example that I provided earlier about losing $20. Remember our friend Ramon, who earns $100 a week, and Elon Musk, who earns $1 million a week. If both pay $20 in sales tax or any other form of consumption tax, then Ramon is paying a much higher rate than Elon Musk, right? And so that is exactly why the sales tax ends up being or charging or imposing a higher cost to low-income households or low-income individuals than someone who has a lot more income or wealth.
Yes, and as Sirisha mentioned, progressive doesn't have any political connotation. And in the same sense, regressive doesn't have any political connotation. It simply has a technical meaning. And according to the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, low-income families typically spend about 3/4 of their income on things that are subject to the sales tax. Middle-income families spend about half their income on items subject to the sales tax. And the richest families spend only about 1/6 of their income on items that are subject to the sales tax. So let me reframe this for you. Put another way, a 6% sales tax is equivalent to an income tax with a 4.5% rate for the poor, a 3% rate on the middle class, and a 1% income tax for the rich. Obviously, no one could get away with proposing an income tax that looked like that. The only reason this pattern is tolerated in consumption taxes is that their regressive nature is hidden in a harmless-looking single rate, and the amount families pay is hidden in many small purchases throughout the year.
And that's incredible, right? Like, I mean, look at how much lower-income households end up paying a lot more in sales tax than households that have way more income. So, and this is particularly important in a place like Jackson County, Missouri. And, you know, according to, I pulled up some data from the Census Bureau Quick Facts, Jackson County has an average income of little less than $37,000. The median household income is higher, but the average income is $37,000. And that's not surprising because Jackson County has a poverty rate of 15%. So that's incredible, right? So a sales tax in Jackson County means that it's going to disproportionately impact a lot of individuals in the county. And the other aspect of taxes that we haven't even gotten into is property tax. Mm-hmm. And what does a tax break in that case mean? So it's really a subsidy that some businesses get, and it impacts whether the state or county or city can fund the services that people require. But that is for another episode. For now, Jackson County residents have their hands full with the April 2 vote on the stadium-related sales tax. And if you haven't completed your income taxes, you know.
It's time.
It's time.
Coming up next, the Dollars and Cents Debrief with Chris Sturr.
This is the DNS Debrief from Dollars and Cents Magazine.
What's college from?
Tyler Bowman.
an inmate at Nash Correctional Institution. This call will be monitored and recorded.
Okay, well, I'm here with Tyler Bowman, who is an inmate at Nash Correctional Institution, and he's a writer, and he's written two articles for Dollars and Cents in recent issues. And his most recent one is about prison labor. So how are you doing?
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I'm doing good, man. Doing good.
So, yeah, well, thanks for calling in. So the title of your piece that we gave it is Forced Labor versus Forced Idleness. So I thought we could start out by just having you explain that.
Yeah. So at some prison facilities in North Carolina, like at my last camp, Marion, everyone that was in general population actually had to have a job. And that was because most of the population was behind the door on what they call RDU program, which is just, you know, it's kind of like North Carolina's answer to solitary confinement nowadays.
But anyway,
as far as having a job there, if you didn't take an assigned job, then they actually could write you up, disciplinary action, and oftentimes that resulted in you going to the hole. Whereas here at Nash, everybody on the yard is general population. So this is about a 1,000-man camp here, and there's enough jobs for only about a quarter of the population. So it's about 750 guys that are not employed, minus probably another 150 for educational programs here. And so you got about 500-600 guys that are just sitting around trying to fill their days in a gym-sized day room or outside on the small rec yard. And because there's not enough opportunities for everyone, the state is actually forcing that idle time upon us, right? You know, a lot of guys want to have a job just to get through the day. But even knowing that they're only getting paid just $1 a day at most, a lot of times, you know, it's not even about...
This call is from a North Carolina correctional facility.
It's not even just about the money. It's about having something to do. But even with that being said, you know, for some of the guys, it is about the money. Yeah, so it's a give and take, you know.
So maybe you can fill people in on what it's like to work in prison and what it's like to not work, like just by talking about the jobs that you've had.
Yeah, so when I first got to prison, like I said, I went to Marion, which is, you know, a camp. They made everybody have a job, so I was fortunate in the sense of I got to have a handful of different jobs in a relatively short amount of time. So when I first got to prison, I worked in the warehouse doing laundry, which was, you know, sorting dirty clothes, you know, tying up dirty boxers and shirts and socks, and then, you know, distributing the clean clothes to the population. From there, my next job was a kitchen worker, where I started out as a cook, which I didn't know how to cook, really, especially on a, you know, kind of commercial, industrial level, you know.
Right.
And then, you know, eventually went to a janitor in the kitchen, and then eventually got on maintenance, which was awesome, because you stay busy, you learn some trades, and, you know, there's a lot of benefits or, you know, going, you know, move around. And then from there, I was a canteen operator, placing orders, unloading trucks, stocking shelves and inventory and stuff like that. But obviously, as you can see through that progression in jobs, it starts out from handling dirty clothes to, you know, being around a bunch of food or learning a trade and stuff like that. So some jobs are kind of menial, while others can actually prepare you for success, I guess, out in the world. But, at the end of the day, there's obvious better jobs, some better than others.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as far as the idleness, if you're not at a job, and like I said, you're kind of sitting around, but even at some of these jobs, a lot of those jobs, you know, you go to work for an hour for the day and you're done. And then even at the job, you know, there's a lot of idleness. You know, working in the kitchen, I was in there for a handful of hours each day, but it was a lot of just standing around. But everybody's kind of just going through the motions. There's no sense of purpose.
Right.
I mean, you're in here, you're doing your time, but you still want to find purpose in your life, especially for guys like myself who've been here for years to decades. And it's like, what are we doing?
Right.
You know
right.
what I mean? You know, it's, you know, or because we're in prison, we can no longer effectively contribute to anything, you
right.
know, and
right.
the only thing we are effectively contributing to is our own incarceration.
Can you talk about pay? You alluded to the fact that prisoners who work in prison don't get paid much for it, but can you just explain how it works?
So in North Carolina, by law, a laborer gets paid no more than $1 a day unless they work for what North Carolina calls correction enterprises, where they're actually, their labors are, you know, going towards making the state money. Yeah, so some guys are not even making $1 a day. They're making, you know, 40, 50, 60 cents. And again, it's just kind of menial task. But a better system provide, even with these menial tasks, you know, more jobs for everyone, but find more fulfilling work for us. Like, you know, even in the correction enterprises, you know, if we could get paid a federal minimum wage, then it gives us a little more self-worth. Even if those wages are garnished to where at the end of the day, you know, it's going right back to the government, garnishing wages for, you know, rent to be at the prison, food, you know, room and board type. You know, because right now the only real-world type jobs available to us are only for the guys that are close to going home through what's called work release programs.
Got it.
You know, and a federal minimum wage would actually allow us to qualify for Social Security credits and Medicare and things like that.
You talk about how prisoners are not eligible for or don't pay into Medicare and Social Security. And you say they're classified as non-workers by law. So I was hoping you could just walk the listeners through that part of your article.
Yeah, so historically, I mean, it kind of ties back to the loophole in the 13th Amendment, which, you know, pretty much allows them to treat us in ways reminiscent of slave labor days. You know, as long as somebody's been convicted of a crime, then you can pretty much do whatever you want to with them, is how the laws were set up back then. And even today's legislators, they've strategically used jargon, you know, where they classify us as non-workers, which, you know, does not entitle us.
This call is from a North Carolina correctional facility.
As non-workers, which do not, you know, entitle us to the same rights and benefits as free laborers. You know, they do that on purpose, again, to kind of keep us under their thumb, you know, make us more reliant on them. I actually met an old man a few weeks ago, right, who works for Correction Enterprises here at the print plant, and he's worked there for more than 20 years at the same print plant. And he was talking about going home in just a handful of years more, and, you know, the whole time I'm just thinking about the disadvantages he's going to face because, you know, obviously recently writing this article, the disadvantages he's going to face on top of just being a convict, being paid so little for so long. He's been working there so long, he knows more than the people supervising him. And he's actually able to perform tasks that otherwise they would have to bring outside skilled technicians in. So he's saving the state essentially hundreds of dollars every time, you know, he performs certain duties that's not even related to his actual job. So, yeah, he's an asset for them, you know, and if it was up to the state, they probably would never let him go if they didn't have to.
Let's talk about one other thing that you brought up in your article, which is mandatory minimums. So maybe you can just explain to the listeners what mandatory minimums are and how they affect work.
What mandatory minimums are is the minimum amount of time a prisoner has to do of his sentence, no matter what he does, good or bad, whether he changes his life, gets his life together, or just raises cane his entire bid. Mandatory minimums does not provide any incentive, really, to better yourself or follow the rules or, you know, anything like that. And again, it's no matter, you know, if you've redeemed yourself or, you know, can get out there and contribute back to society or anything, whatever society or the government's definition of rehabilitation is, once you've reached that, it still is irrelevant until you've done your mandatory minimum on your sentence. You can't earn any more of your life back after that, you know?
Yeah, you mentioned this organization, Families Against Mandatory Minimums, and, you know, I mean, it's interesting to me that a lot of the organizing, I mean, it stands to reason that a lot of the organizing around criminal justice policy is done by family members of prisoners because, you know, so many, I mean, if there are millions of people in prison, there's, you know, millions upon millions of people who, you know, have family members in prison, so.
Exactly. Those are the ones that are going to care about us, you know. Those are the ones that have a direct link. They're directly impacted as well, and they're doing this time with us, you know. So, yeah, it makes sense.
So, yeah, just to wrap up the interview, a lot of what you say, both in this article and in your previous article about prison education and the lack of educational opportunities in prisons, you know, the system is messed up. And I'm just hoping you can finish up by just talking a little bit about why the system is the way it is and what would be a better setup around these issues of labor and education, and then how we could go about changing this.
Yeah, so the system is the way it is today because society does not invest in what happens to their prisoners, at least here in the United States. You know, over the years, politicians have effectively brainwashed that tough-on-crime policies is the answer, and, you know, obviously it's not. We've got overcrowding. overcrowded prisons, understaffed prisons. I mean, the policies in place right now are just not effective. I might not have the solution, but it's definitely what we're going through now is not it. But as a solution, I think it's essential that we do invest more in humane facilities. Right now, especially at the institution I'm at, it was initially designed to just house, you know, 400 or 500 inmates, whereas now, like I mentioned earlier, it's closer to 1,000, which is double its intended capacity. You know, we're crowded together on bunks. There's essentially no personal space. I can reach out and touch the guy beside me. How is that an environment conducive to me getting myself together, my life together? On top of that, providing more education and job programs. And the education programs that they do offer, they need to be of higher level. You know, they pretty much cut us off in here for the most part, GEDs, and again, just basic entry-level trade certifications and stuff like that. And then with the job programs, like we talked about earlier, you know, pay us more wages, at least the federal minimum wage, which would allow us, obviously, to qualify for Social Security and Medicare and things like that. But right now, it's virtually impossible for us to prepare ourselves for when we are released, you know, and the better we can prepare ourselves while we are incarcerated, then the more likely we will succeed upon release, which obviously benefits ourselves, but it, you know, lessens the burden of our families and lessens the burden we place on society. It makes for a safer community. But, you know, as far as actually changing the system, what that's going to come down to is pretty much public education, man. You know, changing this political narrative of those tough on crime policies and educating people that, you know, an effective prison system is not one that just stores human beings and, you know, nothing else. You know, it's, again, in the best interest of all parties involved that we invest in these individuals, these people, you know, because a lot of these people don't have the same opportunities that, you know, people out in the world that do not, you know, get incarcerated had coming up. But what society can do, what people can do as they become more aware of these issues is that they can lobby their politicians, you know, call them up or write them and, you know, see what they're doing to contribute to positive prison reform legislation, because that's what it's going to take. It's going to take the public actually caring and putting pressure on the legislators, and then the legislators coming together and putting a system together that incentivizes people to get their lives together. You know, that is a thing. You know, people you think would want to just naturally get their lives together, but in this environment, it's hard to find that drive. You know, it's a lot of self-determination otherwise, to where if more information was readily available, resources were readily available to us, and opportunities, then I think more people would take advantage of those opportunities and, again, better themselves and hopefully earn some of their life back and, again, contribute to society.
Yeah. So maybe we can give a plug for your book at the end of the interview. You know, so you've been writing articles for Dollars and Cents, but you also had a novel published, Legacy of Stars. Tell us about it.
Yeah, Legacy of Stars, science fiction novel. Main character is Joxie. She's a female space captain. You know, she captains a bandit crew of mechanized bandits, and, you know, they're pretty much, you know, tasked with saving humanity. And, you know, in the meantime, escaping a crazy organization led by Varuna, who is the antagonist, and she's just wild. But, yeah, it's full of some interesting characters. I think people will love it. And, again, you know, it's
available on Amazon.
Somebody who's incarcerated.
Yeah.
We have 30 seconds remaining.
All right. Well,
available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble.
Yeah. Okay. Well, all right. So it sounds like we got to cut this off, but thank you so much, Tyler.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you, Chris. All right, thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah. All right, take care. Bye.
This has been the DNS Debrief from Dollars and Cents Magazine. For more economic analysis, visit dollarsandcents.org.
So that was a very interesting DNS feature, and I really enjoyed that. But we want to move on now to our special feature, talking about industrial disasters. So on December 2nd, 1984, 500,000 people living in towns around Bhopal in central India, and particularly around Union Carbide plant, were exposed to a highly toxic gas, methyl isocyanate. And Amnesty International released a report this morning titled Bhopal, 40 Years of Injustice. And this was released ahead of Dow Chemical, which bought Union Carbide. And they're having an annual general meeting of shareholders on April 11th. And Amnesty describes Bhopal as a sacrifice zone in which 500,000 people across multiple generations are suffering, and more than 22,000 have died as a result of this deadly gas leak, and 8,000 of whom died within 2 weeks of the leak. And this industrial disaster and the continued lack of justice and adequate compensation and the gross environmental injustice that it left in the form of contaminated soil, water, and air really brings to question what is, you know, this desire for rapid economic growth, for profits at any cost. Like, how do we understand that? And particularly in the context of industrial disasters. So in the show prior to us, which is Heartland Labor Forum, Judy Ansel also talked about another form of industrial disaster that happened in East Palestine, Ohio, where, if you recall, last year in February, train got derailed and was carrying toxic materials, and people in East Palestine and their local environment was significantly impacted. So we want to talk about industrial disasters, but we also want to celebrate Women's History Month. And in the case of Bhopal, 40 years of fighting for justice, we want to celebrate the tremendous role that women have played in demanding justice for the people of Bhopal, for themselves, and for their families. And so to talk to us about this issue, we invited our dear friend Madhumita Datta, who is an assistant professor of geography and affiliate faculty in the departments of Women, Gender and Sexuality Studies and Near Eastern and South Asian Languages and Cultures at Ohio State University in the US. And so Madhumita has been working with Bhopal gas survivors for over two decades as a volunteer with the International Campaign for Justice in Bhopal. So Madhu, are you on air and can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Thanks, Sirisha.
I'm so glad we have you. I know we had some technical
problems. Thank you. Yeah, so Madhu, thank you for being on the show. I was wondering, for our listeners, could you briefly describe the state of the people who were impacted by the leak?
You mean their state in terms of conditions, health conditions?
Yes, conditions, their ability to survive, to eke out a livelihood. Uh-huh. Yes.
Right. Yeah. So I guess you already have introduced, but, you know, in terms of people who were exposed and subsequent generations born to people who were exposed to the to methyl isocyanate that night, what we are seeing, like over 100,000 people still continue to battle with chronic diseases, you know, all kinds of health issues. Rates of cancers are high, tuberculosis, fatal kidney, brain, heart, all sorts of ailments, and especially women have massive reproductive health issues. So this also, and they have been hugely immune compromised. So their ability to do work itself has been compromised, to eke out a living. So, and these are mostly working class people. So both economically, socially, and health wise, it's been ongoing disaster for the last 40 years for the survivors of the Bhopal gas disaster.
Right. So, you know, this thing, industrial disasters, right? Like, we've used this term, but it seems like such a convenient label, as if it was beyond anyone's control. But even prior to this catastrophic leak in 1984, labor unions and investigative journalists in Bhopal had been reporting about alleged negligence in the plant, in the union, you know, what was then a Union Carbide plant and then got taken over by Dow Chemical. And the plant was producing highly toxic materials. Workers were impacted by it, but they were not provided safety gear. So can you talk a little bit about this kind of negligence that wasn't just specifically restricted to December 2nd and 3rd, 1984, but, you know, there's this history of negligence.
Right, yeah, yes, yeah. There's been a lot of things that has since come out, has been revealed in Union Carbide's own internal documents that clearly showed how Union Carbide and now its present owner Dow continues to discriminate. Bhopal is really a classic example of corporate double standards. I mean, there are these 50-page-long internal documents of Union Carbide, which, you know, which were all revealed through various discovery process in the courts, which kind of never talked about the risks to the surrounding community and the fact that the Bhopal factory was just a mile away from the factory and what impact MIC, methyl isocyanate, which leaked that night, could have. And just to kind of give a context, like Union Carbide had built a state-of-the-art facility in West Virginia and was supposed to be actually duplicating the same facility with same kind of technology in Bhopal when it was building its MIC plant, but instead it installed an inferior technology, and this was very well known to them. And Union Carbide Corporation held 50% share of their subsidiaries. They had full control over the design, the management, everything. They kind of knew everything what was going on. And despite having a huge sizable community around the factory periphery between 1977 and 1984, you know, the Union Carbide factory was licensed by the Madhya Pradesh state government to manufacture phosgene, monomethylamine, methyl isocyanate, carbaryl, all these is a pesticide they were making. So, and before 1984, they knew what was going on. Especially in 1981, there was a worker who got killed in the plant and many were severely injured. In 1982, 25 workers were hospitalized. Workers were constantly sounding alarm about the kind of conditions of work. In fact, they had voiced their concerns to the American officials when they were visiting in those years the Bhopal factory, but nothing was done. And in fact, in 1982, Union Carbide had sent a team from America led by a person called C.S. Tyson to do a business confidential audit of the factory. And they clearly said in their report that there is deficiency in the safety system. There is a possibility, and we have all those reports, that there is a possibility of disaster. And in fact, they noted in the safety audit that there were 61 hazards, at least 30 of which were major, and 11 of which were specifically identified as hazards in the dangerous MIC phosgene unit. And they had said, in quotes, higher potential for a serious incident of more serious consequences. But nothing, this is the thing, nothing was done with the report in the India plant. Instead, they made improvement in the MIC plant in West Virginia, but not in Bhopal. And the thing to remember is there were a lot of cost cutting that was done. MIC, which was stored in this Bhopal plant where they were manufacturing, storing, had to be kept under particular refrigerated condition in cold temperatures. And as part of the cost cutting, Union Carbide shut off the refrigeration unit in, I think, 1982. And the cost to run those refrigeration units was just $37 a day on the freon gas. So, you know, people's lives were not even worth $37, you know, for Union Carbide. So the reporter, the local reporter, Mr. Rajkumar Keshwani, had been writing about it in the Hindi newspapers, asking Bhopal people to wake up. He was constantly revealing what was going on because he was talking to the workers. So it was there. The writing was on the wall. They knew what they were doing.
And just for our listeners, when Madhu was referring to MIC, she's talking about the toxic gas methyl isocyanate. And Madhu, one of the things that in the show prior to us, Judy Ansel in the Heartland Labor Forum had a segment on the industrial disaster in East Palestine, Ohio. And I just wanted to, like, just draw parallels, like, that in terms of rail workers, how they had been raising concern and continue to raise concern about safety issues and the kind of working conditions and so on. And those kinds of concerns seem to be constantly discounted or ignored. And hence, we had this disaster in East Palestine last year in Ohio, which is actually not very far from where you're from.
Right. And there is another connection. What the train was carrying was vinyl chloride.
Oh.
And Dow Chemical is the biggest producer of this.
There you go.
Chemical.
Yes.
So there is a clear connection.
Absolutely.
You know, and Dow Chemicals has been, or corporation, is also one of the worst polluters in this country. I mean, there are reports that show that. Yeah, I mean, it's all very connected.
Connected, yeah. And I mean, just for our listeners, to make the connections more clear, we just recently had a situation where a cargo ship collided with a bridge in Baltimore, rendering it inoperable and killing approximately 9 of the workers that were working on the bridge at the time. So this topic of industrial disasters is always pertinent, but I have kind of a clarification, a curiosity question, Madhu. You mentioned that there was a lot of reporting, I didn't know this, a lot of reporting done in advance of the disaster. Can you say, how did the local politicians react to this? I mean, was it on their radar? Was there anything going on there?
Well, you know, that's the thing with Bhopal. Bhopal is the story of, yes, corporate double standard, but also the kind of complicity of the state and elected representatives and politicians. And it was constantly being, and including, and there was a U.S. government's role in this. So there was the U.S. government, and there was the Indian government, there was the state government, the elected representative. Yes, all these reports were coming out, but there was never anything done about it. In fact, the fact that MIC plant was allowed to be located just a couple of miles away from railway station is actually a violation of Indian law, even at that time. But still, it was allowed. And so you know, there has been a lot of that kind of complicity with the elected representatives, politicians, and it still continues in every government that has come into power. So yes, it was there, and yet nothing was being done.
And I call it gross negligence, but you know, I remember that in fact Dow knew what the remedy was and didn't offer it to people immediately. Is that correct, or am I misremembering?
This is a Union Carbide.
Union Carbide.
They knew. I mean, they knew. Even till date, they have not really revealed what would be the, you know, antidote.
Antidote.
And it is, yeah.
Yes.
I mean, it's criminal.
It is
a criminal. It's a crime.
Yes, like to humanity, right? And this is the issue with justice,
right? Exactly,
it's
a crime to humanity,
yes.
And that's what Amnesty is calling, like,
yes.
This is a sacrificial zone.
Exactly.
This is a sacrificial area.
Right. What was the economic context, Madhu? The legalities were also undermined in order to make allowances for the Union Carbide plant. So what was that economic context which led Union Carbide and then Dow Chemicals, both American companies, how did they find themselves in Bhopal in the 1980s?
So, I mean, it's a long kind of history, and it is also tied to the type of in the 1950s and the Green Revolution. And so UCC, that is Union Carbide Corporation, had already created an Indian subsidiary. I think that was in the 1930s or something. But a couple of decades later, in the 1950s, with the international agricultural boom, the development of new seeds, which were yielding huge harvests, Union Carbide got into the food production business. That was, you know, at that time, this whole Green Revolution, that was an experiment here in the U.S., experimented in Mexico by U.S. scientists. That was the time Union Carbide got into it to make all these pesticides, to reap into this financial boom and increase its sales. And so it built a new pesticide formulation factory in India. India was at that time, of course, talking about hunger, and, you know, we had M.S. Swaminathan, agricultural scientist, talking about the Green Revolution. So there was, you know, convergence of multiple things that came, and here was this corporation. If you look at some of the ads that Union Carbide was putting out in India at that time, basically showing how it was you know, pull India out of hunger. So there was all that narrative that was out there. But anyway, in the midst of all this, they set up this plant in the late 60s in Bhopal. Initially, they were importing the MIC, but later they started manufacturing it. So it was in 1969, through its subsidiary, UCIL, that is Union Carbide India Limited, Madhya Pradesh government leased the land to Union Carbide. So it was within this context of development, you know, both in term and also in terms of food security, Union Carbide came into India. And much later, of course, in 2001, Dow, which is also a huge chemical corporation, in 2001, it bought Union Carbide. And it was already had established business in India, making pesticides. In fact, the pesticide that Dow wanted to make in India, Durspan, which is banned in the United States, that's the pesticide Dow wanted to make, manufacture in India, which also led to a huge amount of protests. It was setting up a factory near Pune in Maharashtra. But, you know,
and that's Western India for listeners who are unfamiliar with Indian geography.
Right. Yeah. Pune. Yeah. Western India. Yes. So, you know, this whole idea of economic development and growth, in fact, through the Right to Information Act, using Right to Information Act in India, we actually revealed the kind of conversation, the kind of exchanges that happened between the CEO of Dow and the chairperson of the Planning Commission of India during that time in the early 2000s, and at that time the Prime Minister of India, Manmohan Singh, of Congress, and the kind of exchanges that were happening, where Dow was saying that they were going to invest $1 billion in India if they were let off the liability of or any kind of liability, a Bhopal-related liability, because as per Indian and U.S. law, Dow Chemical, that took over Union Carbide, is legally liable for the kind of issues that, and we can talk about it, issues that are ongoing in Bhopal, that is soil and groundwater contamination under polluter pays and successor liability principles. On paper, Indian government does hold Dow Chemical liable for those harms, but nothing really has happened in the sense that, you know, it doesn't seem they're very serious about it. I mean, and so Dow Chemical did not want this kind of liability. So therefore, there was this whole idea that we will invest if you let us off any sort of liability. So there was a lot of those kind of shenanigans going on. Still is going on.
And, you know, the thing that I just wanted to emphasize, of course, is that even though they talked about food security, etc., for Dow and for Union Carbide before that, and many other companies that came into India at that time, they were really in there because there were opportunities for profits and investment. You know, food security became this. I mean, it seemed like a convenient excuse, but all sorts of issues that the farmers had to face was quite incredible, which, of course, is not for a conversation today. But just wanted to point that out, that it was not all smooth sailing, even outside of that.
Exactly right. It was in the name of food security, but it was also this massive market and profit, you know, profit making. And now we know the conditions of farmers in
yes.
Punjab and other places, which were supposed to be, you know, the bowl of the whole green revolution. That's where it heart of green revolution. So, yeah, absolutely. It is completely a profit making venture.
Yeah, I have so many questions and there's such limited time. Madhu, I just wanted to piggyback off something that you said. So I think most of our listeners have in mind the plume of toxic smoke that rose from the train wreck in Ohio. Can you elaborate a little bit more about the ecological impacts? You kind of mentioned water and air, but if you could maybe say a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I really want to mention this because there's so much of conversation around compensation. So I do want to mention that, you know, that 93% of the 500,000 survivors of the disasters have received anywhere, you know, less than $500 as compensation for lifelong injuries. You know, and there are so many different kind of figures floating around. But what a lot of people do not really know is the continuing, you know, disaster that is going on, which is because of this contamination, and which is the contamination of ground and soil water. In fact, government reports are showing there is dangerous concentration of poisonous chemicals and pesticides, heavy metals in the groundwater around the abandoned Union Carbide factory. And the source of this contamination is the hazardous waste that was buried in the unlined pits in and outside the factory premise. between 1969 and 1984. So it's not just what just leaked from those, you know, from the MIC tanks, but also what was put in the ground and the solar evaporation pond that they had. It was constantly getting filled during monsoon and contaminating the surrounding area. So all these things have, over a period of time, has leached into the ground and water. There are 42 water contaminated communities with over 2 lakh people, mostly a lot of them children, who are suffering due to this contamination. And this is what the Bhopalis are demanding from Dow to clean up. And it's an ongoing environmental disaster in Bhopal. So Bhopal just did not happen and end in 1984. It's a continuing disaster.
Yeah, and I teach this ecological class every year, and I actually show my students clips of documentaries on Bhopal and the disaster, and they're always speechless because it's so striking and it's so horrifying, the impact that we see on, continue to see on children and the younger generations, the impact of all of this contamination.
Mm-hmm.
Madhu, we're coming to an end or closer to the end of our show, but like, you know, one of the things that has been very, very uplifting is the tremendous amount of organizing that has occurred, you know, 40 years and people have continued to organize, but the organization, you know, has been particularly a women. So in celebration and in honor of a Women's History Month, and you have also been involved in these efforts for 2 decades. So can you speak to this, you know, the women who have organized, who continue to organize and demand justice for people of Bhopal, their families and themselves?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's been, you know, they have been organizing, women and men, but really women have been really at the forefront of it since the disaster. And two women I would like to mention. I mean, there are hundreds of them, but two women, Rashida B and Champa Devi Shukla, who also won the 2004 Goldman Environmental Prize, you know, they gave a call and they said, "Hum Bhopal ke nari hai, hum phool nahi chingari hai." That is, we are the women of Bhopal. We are flames, not flowers. And these women, you know, had, they actually, it's a very interesting story. In 1986, these two women who are themselves Bhopal gas disaster survivors and lost so many people in their families to the disaster and to cancer and other ailments. And they actually met at a stationery factory that was part of, you know, there was all these economic livelihood projects that was post-disaster that happened. So they met at one of those factories. They founded a union for better work and better conditions of work and wages, and they struggled for labor rights. And that culminated into a 468 miles march to New Delhi to meet the Prime Minister. 100 women marched. They sold their jewelry, their valuables to join this march, and they finally won a campaign for better work conditions and wages. And that was really heart of a lot of the work that happens and continues to happen around organizing. And there had been two very big marches in 2006 and 2008 from Bhopal to Delhi. Countless women have led those, you know, marches. And
Madhu, I'm afraid we're out of time, unfortunately.
Oops, sorry.
For our listeners, feel free to Google the Amnesty International report, which has just come out. We've been speaking with Madhu Mittadatta, professor of geography at OSU, about the Bhopal disaster. Thank you very much, Madhu.
Thank you, Dr.
Thanks, Madhu.
Thank you, Sarisha. Bye.
Bye.
Yeah, okay, bye.
The views and opinions aired by the hosts and guests on the show do not reflect those of their employers, KKFI, or its board. الوضع بده الرضع صار الوضع بده الردع لكل الكيد بتحرر مستوطن بتلمت بدل يوصف حكيت ألف كان ألف رق بالهدار الإعلام سلاحهم طيب فبركوت أما لما ألمي يدي برجع الواقع تمام
nazca trileo o el mapu. Mil veces venceremos, del cielo al suelo y del suelo al cielo vamos. Carlito blanco, vuelve para.